Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Topher Brown, and he'll be answering your most important questions on Atlantic salmon magic. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Topher a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Topher Brown about Atlantic salmon. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. To view their fishing products and guide services they offer in both Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about the Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. Before we introduce Topher, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Topher's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We will also be giving away a copy of Topher's latest book, Atlantic Salmon Magic, courtesy of Wild River Press. And here's how you can win this beautiful coffee table and instructional book that you won't want to be without if you're looking for Atlantic salmon. You've got to be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something Topher and I talk about during the show. You have to submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and maybe you win this beautiful and educational book. Tonight our guest is Topher Brown. Topher worked as a professional guide for many years and has fished for Atlantic salmon in Canada, Iceland, Scotland, Norway, and Russia. He is a casting instructor and the author of Atlantic Salmon Magic, published by Wild River Press in 2011. He also co-wrote and co-produced Spey Casting DVD titled Spey to Z, which was published in 2006. Topher was trained and mentored in fly tying by the late Warren Duncan of St. John, New Brunswick. His superb flies appear in various magazines and books, including a companion volume to the Atlantic Salmon Magic titled 100 Best Flies for Atlantic Salmon. He lives in Portland, Maine, close to many Atlantic salmon waters. Topher, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Roger, thanks very much. It's good to be here.
Yeah, well, we've got a ton of questions, as usual, from our audience, who never seem to let me down, and I think they overdid it this time, so we've got a lot to talk about tonight.
Sounds good.
So, and we'll just get going right away here and dig in. So tonight we're talking about Atlantic salmon, and we're going to cover a little bit of history about Atlantic salmon, a little bit about its future. We're going to talk about equipment needed and flies and presentation techniques and destinations and all kinds of things. So let's just dive right in, Topher. Let's first, if you could, describe the Atlantic salmon as a fish, its characteristics, spawning activities, and migration, so we kind of get a picture of who this fish is.
You bet. Atlantic salmon is an anadromous species, which means that it's born in fresh water but migrates to the ocean, where it does its primary feeding, putting on weight, before returning once again to fresh water in order to spawn. And so there are many different types of anadromous fish, Pacific salmon, of which there are five species, steelhead, another famous type of anadromous fish from the west coast of the United States and Canada. Atlantic salmon differ from Pacific salmon in that they don't necessarily die after spawning, so we do get repeat spawners for Atlantic salmon. And its range is on the western side of the Atlantic is the state of Maine and then up through New Brunswick and Nova Scotia to Quebec, Labrador, and Newfoundland. And then heading east towards Europe, there is one or two rivers in the continent of Greenland. Iceland has 80 or 90 rivers, and there are salmon rivers as far south in Europe as the northern coast of Spain. France has several salmon rivers in recovery, and England, Scotland, and Ireland are all still in excellent shape as far as sport fishing goes. And Russia, Norway, Sweden, and many of the Baltic countries also have still sustainable runs of Atlantic salmon, and Russia is considered the finest place to probably fish for Atlantic salmon today in terms of pure numbers. The salmon spawns in the fall, so it's October, in the southern reaches of the domain of the salmon, even as late as November. And it's a fish that will go to the ocean for as many as 3 and maybe occasionally 4 years, but 1 year, 1 winter at sea or 2 winters at sea is more traditional. So we call the 1 winter sea fish a grilse. We call a 2 sea winter fish just a 2 sea winter fish. A 3 sea winter fish coming back from 3 complete winters out in the ocean, coming back to spawn, will be a pretty good sized fish. They typically run earlier in the season, usually in northern rivers in late May and the month of June, and they can be anywhere from 20 to 30 pounds and larger. And as I mentioned before, we do also have repeat spawners. There are some fish that, based on scale sampling, we know they've spawned as many as 4 or 5 times. Always important to release fish because many of them can spawn again. And that's sort of a general overview of the Atlantic salmon.
That's great. Do they know why certain ones go back to sea after spawning and don't die? Is there any?
I think it depends on what kind of shape they're in after they spawn. Most of the scientific evidence is females are more likely to be repeat spawners than males. Males seem to beat each other up pretty well during spawning time, so their physical reserves may be reduced at that point in time. Females seem to survive spawning better than the males, but I do know of a few very large fish over 50 pounds, which are certainly males, which they know have spawned 3 and 4 times. So I don't think there's any hard and fast rule. It really depends on the environment and the general shape of the fish when it swims into the river and what kind of shape it's in after the spawning season is over. So there's a lot of variables there.
Right. We've got a question that came in from Alexander in London and over in the UK where they do a lot of Atlantic salmon fishing. And I know you just came back from a...
I'm still jet-lagged from my return here from London, so...
Well, he asks, what's the future of Atlantic salmon as a species, given all the threats salmon are facing currently, for example, overfishing, fewer feeding grounds, drift netting, genetic deterioration due to farmed fish interbreeding, and wild fish, to mention just a few. That's enough right there.
Yeah, that's a handful.
You know, in your opinion, will we still, as fly fishermen, have salmon to fish for in, say, 20 to 30 years?
That's a good question, Alexander, and I think definitely there will definitely be salmon to fish for in 20 or 30 years' time. I think we'll see some variations locally, particularly at the southern reaches of the current distribution pattern for Atlantic salmon. So southern England, France, Spain, if most of the current climate change models are accurate, they may be in trouble in the next 20 or 30 years. It seems like the general environment for the Atlantic salmon is being compressed from both the northern end, where water seems to be getting colder, and compressed from the southern end, where water seems to be getting warmer. So as long as fish are within the habitat of fish are within reasonable extremes, I think definitely we'll have salmon to fish for. The general trend, I think, has been stable in the last few years in terms of the decline, if you will, of the Atlantic salmon. And it seems to have stabilized within the last 5 or 10 years. But we're still way below where we were, say, in the 1960s and the 1970s. And so that return to abundance is something that all the conservation organizations are looking to achieve. And I think it's important not to take current numbers and be satisfied with them and forget that there used to be an awful lot more salmon around at one point. And because I think that can lead to a certain amount of complacency on our part in terms of making sure that we're doing the best thing we can for salmon. But short answer to your question, we'll definitely be fishing for them in 30 years, no question about it. I don't know if we may have to do a little bit more traveling in order to get to them, but I don't think it's going to change that quickly.
Is there any particular country right now that's doing a better job in, you know, protecting?
Yes, absolutely, Roger. I think if you look to Iceland, they manage their fishery exceptionally well. They have a very good idea of how many fish are returning to their rivers and how many, what sort of an escapement they need in terms of maximum sustainability for a run. They're very careful in terms of the number of fish that they harvest from individual fisheries to ensure that they do have that necessary escapement at spawning time. And I think Russia's done a pretty good job, but I think their job has been made much easier by the difficulty of travel to many of the salmon rivers. In other words, you really need a helicopter to get into many of those rivers. Poaching has certainly been a problem on some of those rivers nonetheless, but I think the Russians have done a very good job at protecting one of the most pristine resources for Atlantic salmon. But if I had to look to anybody for a model, I would look to Iceland.
Okay.
I think they do an exceptional job of managing their resource.
Duke in New York asks, what is going on in terms of Atlantic salmon restoration efforts in the USA? How can we fly fishing community participate and support these efforts?
There are currently a number of rivers that are in restoration in the state of Maine, which is the only state in the U.S. that still has wild populations of Atlantic salmon. And the Penobscot River had a run of over 3,000 fish this year, which a good number of those fish are of hatchery origin, or they may be wild fish, but they are certainly raised to either par or smolt size in a hatchery. So those numbers can be a little bit deceiving. They're not naturally reproducing fish. But the Penobscot represents our best and perhaps our last opportunity to restore Atlantic salmon numbers in healthy populations to the United States. It's a big river system. The Atlantic Salmon Federation, the Maine Natural Resources Council, the feds in Washington are in the process of orchestrating a $25 million buyout of the two lower dams on the Penobscot, which when they're removed, which should be done in the next 10 or 15 years would be my guess, will open up a tremendous amount of spawning territory to all species of anadromous fish, whether they be salmon or striped bass or eels, what have you. And so I think the best way to get involved with that is to join the Atlantic Salmon Federation, which is www.asf.ca for Canada, or join Trout Unlimited. They're also doing superb work in concert with the Atlantic Salmon Federation, and lend your voice to that conservation effort. There are a few smaller rivers which have runs of generally anywhere from 25 to maybe 150 fish. They're called the Down East Rivers, and those rivers are currently in restoration as well, and we certainly hope that those rivers which flow into the Gulf of Maine and the Bay of Fundy are on the way up, because it's been a long spiral down in terms of numbers for those rivers.
Richard in Worcestershire, Massachusetts, asked about the Connecticut River. Is that one of those rivers?
The Connecticut is, I think they've spent a tremendous amount of money on the Connecticut. If my memory serves, it's in the neighborhood of $150 million and up. And I kind of wish they'd taken that amount of money and put it into rivers such as the Penobscot or even the Down East Rivers, which I think have a better opportunity for restoration. I don't want to give up on the Connecticut River, but it is got a lot of dams on the river, which are a barrier to migration. It flows out at somewhere in Connecticut into fairly warm water, which I think limits the seasonal migration of fish. If they were to migrate up the Connecticut, it's probably going to have to be when ocean water temperatures are below 70 degrees. So I don't think it's been a great success story, the Connecticut. You know, there's maybe 1 to 200 fish coming back, and that may not be the best use of $150 million.
I think we could
do better on other rivers that currently have wild fish in them.
Well, even when you said earlier that in Maine they were just getting 3,000 fish, to me 3,000 fish doesn't sound like very many.
Yeah, it doesn't.
You know, we talk about 4,000 fish miles here in the Rocky Mountains for trout, you know.
That's right.
For a whole river, that doesn't seem like much.
That's right. And, you know, those numbers are historically, I mean, the run would have been at least 100,000. So when we're getting very excited about 3,000 fish, which are primarily of hatchery origin, it should, I think, temper our enthusiasm a little bit in terms of what the historical numbers were. It's still a step in the right direction, but you know, it shouldn't be our final goal. Our final goal is to have a self-sustaining population that doesn't need a hatchery to supplement it, and hopefully with some numbers that are a little bit better than what we're currently seeing.
Now, are those rivers that you spoke of in the U.S., are those all protected? Are you even allowed
They are. The endangered species listing is currently in effect for Atlantic salmon. And so there are 7 downeast rivers, and then the Penobscot, which would be 8th river, which is also protected under the Endangered Species Act. And so it is illegal to fish for Atlantic salmon at this point, which is appropriate given their numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty grim. I would say, you know, I've always thought it was cool to live on the East Coast because I could live in one country where I could go fishing for bonefish and Atlantic salmon, all on the same seaboard. And I hope that we'll be able to fish for Atlantic salmon again here in the state of Maine. I used to do it back in the 80s and 90s, and it was great to have it in your backyard. I think we'll see it again.
Okay. We've got Dean in Westford just asked a question online. He's asking about the restoration on the Merrimack, which I guess is in New Hampshire.
That's right.
And also Leo, who sent a question in early, was asking about the Merrimack. He said something about, Leo was asking about a large uptick on the number of Atlantic salmon returning to the Gas, Maritimes, and Maine rivers this year.
That's right.
And he said the Merrimack had over 400 salmon trapped at a dam. So is all that on the positive side here?
I think it is, no question about it. It's been a very good year for Atlantic salmon. All over Canada, the U.S., and even in Scotland, they've had good returns, above average returns for Atlantic salmon, which points to Leo's question. Hi, Leo. And, you know, I think the, you know, he's asking why the uptick, and I think it points to good marine survival. In other words, the growing conditions out to sea have been good. And the most dangerous time for an Atlantic salmon is when they're juveniles and they swim out. They're very susceptible to cold temperatures when their body mass is smaller. And if they don't find appropriate food species in the right size at the right time, they may not get to the point where they are large enough to consume the next size species that becomes available. So there's a whole host of factors that would have to fall into line for good marine survival of smolts, the little guys, if you will. And I think we probably had good marine survival during the winter time, probably 2 years ago, would be my guess. And so that smolt class that went out, a lot of them made it through the winter. And they managed to put on weight. They're now coming back as 2C winter fish in the, you know, anywhere from 8 to 12, 13 pounds, something like that. And they're in good shape. But 1 year does not make a trend. And I think you have to, you know, be excited about, you know, 1 year where you have an uptick, but, you know, we could follow that with a bad year for next year. I'd like to see a trend like this go on for 3 out of 5 years for a period of 15 years, and then we would know we were headed in the right direction. But it's always good to see lots of fish in the river as both a conservationist and particularly as a fisherman.
Right, right. Well, Topher, we need to take a quick break, but when we
come
back, we'll talk more about salmon, get into equipment and so forth. So, everybody, hang tight with me for just a few seconds. Women's Fly Fishing Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's Fly Fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.com. .net. That's www.womensflyfishing.net. or you can call Pudge at 907-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Topher Brown about Atlantic Salmon Magic. If you'd like to ask Topher a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Topher, at this point in the show, I always ask my guests, what's going on in your fly fishing world? What have you been up to? And tell us a little bit about your book and also, you know, how people can get a hold of that book.
You bet. I'm just back from the United Kingdom, where I was traveling around promoting the book. I went to the prestigious game fair at Blenheim Palace this year, which was really a mind-altering experience. I've never seen an outdoor show so large. It's about a square mile of booths. It takes the better part of an hour to walk across it. And it's more than just fly fishing, although there's lots of stuff with fly fishing. There's hunting and equestrian sports and dog training and all kinds of shooting stands where you can try out new shotguns and spey casting and fly tying competitions. And I've never seen that much enthusiasm for country sports, and I would love to see something like that in this country. But the English and the Scottish and the Irish, they certainly love their country sports. And so I had a booth there where I was selling or promoting the book, which is entitled Atlantic Salmon Magic. It was about a four-year project. It took me about 3 years to write and a year to put together. And the putting it together part with all the photos and the illustrations was probably the toughest part, laying it out. And it's a compilation of a lot of research and reading that I've done, both on the techniques of the game, but also on the science and what's going on with Atlantic salmon, how they navigate in the open ocean, how they find the feeding grounds most probably as juvenile fish, how they return. And the title, Atlantic Salmon Magic, is about the special experiences that we all have when we go fishing for Atlantic salmon. But it's also, I think, the magic of a fish that is born in fresh water, swims out to 3,000 or 4,000 miles, or even 4,000 miles away out into the ocean, and then returns to the same spot that it was born in order to spawn. That's a pretty magical story as well, so I try to bring that across in the book.
And where can people get the book?
The best place to get it is directly from the publisher. It's Wild River Press, and the internet address is www.wildriverpress.com. And just place an internet order for it. And you can also go on to the website and place a phone order, but the internet order is a little quicker. And sometimes my publisher, Mr. Tom Perro, is off fishing, so the internet orders will still be shipped even when he is wetting a line. So that's a good thing.
Good, good. Well, good. Well, thanks for sharing that. And now you can go back to fishing, right?
Yeah, it's not been a lot of fishing for me this summer. It's been a lot of traveling and promoting, and I'm glad to hear there's lots of fish in the rivers, and hopefully I'll go get to chase a few of them here shortly.
We did have somebody inquire on the internet about stocking Atlantic salmon, and what's going on with that? How does it work into the whole system? And
stocking salmon is a controversial subject because there are strains of fish that are unique to, or that are very unique to specific river sources, so, or resources. So if you introduce a foreign strain of Atlantic salmon into a river and you already have a pre-existing strain of wild fish, then it's probably not the best thing if you're trying to create a self-sustaining population. Stocking of salmon in wild rivers is generally where they remove wild fish from the rivers as broodstock, take them to a hatchery, and use the specific strain of the fish that has been adapting to that particular river shed since the last ice age as your broodstock. And that seems to be the best way to go. Using it a non-native species or an exotic species of Atlantic salmon, if you will, from another river shed is sometimes done when you have a river that is devoid of fish. So sometimes they'll go to a river system that's fairly close and take a few broodstock from a river that, you know, may have had a similar strain of fish and attempt to reintroduce it to the fish. Most of the conservation efforts are targeted at self-sustaining populations of fish, so not maintaining fisheries by hatcheries. Hatcheries are, as far as most conservation organizations are concerned, they are not the goal. We want the fish to do their thing in the river naturally. So that's where most of the efforts are being concentrated right now.
Okay, okay. Let's talk about equipment. We've got a question from Duke in New York. He said, out of the double-handed cast methods, Skagit, Scandinavian, and traditional, which one do you prefer for most of the Atlantic salmon fishing, and why? And maybe you can compare that to single-handed, too. Maybe that's your preference.
Sure.
Could you talk about those methods?
You bet. I think it's a good question by Duke. And the, you know, I try and take my personal preference out of things and give a relatively unbiased view. First of all, just to preface it, I would say, you know, there's three styles of casting that he's mentioned here, the Skagit, the Scandinavian, and the traditional style. Two of those were developed for Atlantic salmon, Scandinavian and traditional spey casting. Scandinavian obviously coming out of Norway and Sweden, traditional coming out of Scotland. And the Skagit style was developed more for steelhead, particularly winter steelhead, in the Pacific Northwest. All three have applications for Atlantic salmon, and it's a question of picking the right tool for the job, if you will. In terms of answering Duke's question, my favorite is the Scandinavian style. I think it's the most versatile style for Atlantic salmon in that it allows you to spey cast with not that much room behind you and still make good long casts to cover the water. It's also much easier if you fish sinking lines with a shooting head like a Scandinavian style shooting head. It's much easier to get those lines up to the surface before you make your next cast. If you have a traditional style 55 or 60 foot long sinking line, they can be tough to get out of the water before you make your next cast. Then I think the Scandinavian style is also a little better in terms of fishing fast flies. Yes, you can do it on sink tips, but in my experience, Atlantic salmon, as opposed to steelhead or as compared to steelhead, they seem to like a faster fly anyway than steelhead do. And Scandi line.
Faster, you mean retrieving?
Faster in terms of the swing. So if you've got if you've got moving water in front of you and you were to cast across the current, we tend to cast at maybe just below, for summer fishing anyway, just below straight across and pretty much let her rip, as I say, just let her come around. That would be probably fairly quick on most steelhead rivers. And when the water gets colder and you have to get your flies down, we do slow stuff down. Because the fish is a cold water animal, and so it doesn't move quite as quickly when the water temperatures get down into the low 50s, 40s, and even down into the 30s. And that's when sinking lines become effective. But I would say we still fish a little faster fly for Atlantic salmon, and Scandinavian shooting heads are really dialed in to a whole range of presentations throughout the water column a little bit better, I think, than Skagit lines. Although that is changing, and there's lots of different Skagit lines that are now available. But I prefer the Scandinavian style, and I think it's exceptionally versatile. But there are definitely applications for Skagit-style shooting heads, such as some of the what we call pot fishing, which is where you have a lot of boulders, and the fish may be in a pot inside the boulders. And early season fishing on the north coast of the Kola Peninsula would be an excellent example where a Skagit line, really a nice line to have. The floating portion of the belly keeps it out of the boulders, and then the fast sinking tip and perhaps even a weighted fly gets it into the pot where the fish are. But I think that's a fairly unusual circumstance, and in general, I find the Scandi lines to be more versatile than the Skagit head for most salmon fishing.
Do you do most of your salmon fishing with double-handed?
I do, and I find it easier. If you can get two hands on a rod, it's generally less tiring, and you can cover more water. You can also spey cast. I know you can spey cast on a single-handed rod, no question about it, but it's generally more work, and you certainly can't cover lies at 75 and 80 feet with the same ease that you could on a double-handed rod. So I would say for all wet fly fishing, I am now using two-handed rods. The only time I use a single-handed rod these days is for dry fly fishing. And I would really say only when I can see the fish or I know exactly where they are. And there's a lot of rivers that I fish in the Gaspé, which are very clear rivers, and you can actually see the fish that you're fishing to with a dry fly. And for that game, accuracy is exceptionally important, and I prefer about a 9'8" weight. And for my all the rest of it, I generally use about a 13'7" or a 13'8" weight, something in that range, with about a 510-grain Scandinavian shooting head on there. And if I had two setups to fish for the rest of my days, that would probably be my choice, about a 9'8" weight and 13'7" weight.
Mm-hmm.
And switch rods, I do fish dry flies off of switch rods, the switch rod being an 11-foot two-handed rod. But I generally fish blind I usually use those for blind fishing. In other words, I can't see the fish, and I'm just covering water very, very precisely with a switch rod. Not quite as accurate as the single-hander, but they are less work. And when you're trying to cover a lot of water with a dry fly, which usually means lots of casting, less work is good.
Now, Duke was also inquiring about particular place or river system in Canada or the U.S. that might be suitable for these kinds of, you know, the Scandinavian techniques and so forth. Well, we already know U.S. is out, right?
U.S. is out just because the fishery is closed.
Yeah. So you could probably go practice there without a
you can.
Hook,
absolutely,
right?
Yeah. And actually, the two-handed rod is making inroads into striped bass fishing from the surfs.
Oh,
overhead, wow. Overhead casting with a 12-foot rod is, I think, a lot less tiring than overhead casting with a 9'9" weight, which would be sort of traditional fare for stripers.
Right.
But I think the question is a good one, you know, and it's basically, you know, when would you use a two-handed rod and when might you use a single-handed rod? And are there places where you might need a two-handed rod in Canada? And absolutely. And you can fish a two-handed rod on virtually any river, that is not exceptionally tiny. I do know of a lot of the salmon rivers that are quite small. They may be 25 feet across, and that's probably not the best place for a 15-foot 10-weight, shall we say. Single-handed rod will get the job done very nicely on something small like that. But virtually anywhere else you go, any sort of medium to large size rivers, you can fish wet flies with a two-handed rod, and that would be my first choice. And that's any river. But rivers change throughout the season. If you go up to a salmon river in June during runoff, you definitely want to have a two-handed rod. You could go back to that same river at the end of August in low water, and a two-handed rod on the same pool might be the wrong tool because the water is so much lower. The fish may be pooled up in a low water situation, and you want to approach them more stealthily, perhaps, with a single-handed rod. So it's really about conditions and less about specific river systems. And there are rivers where I fish low down on the river even in August with a two-handed rod. But if I go way upriver where it tends to be not quite as big, I'll switch over to a single-handed rod even in the same day. So this is good news for the fly shop guys because they get to sell you lots of gear.
Yeah, and more gear.
And more gear is as long as it doesn't, you know, get you divorced, it's
right.
Never a bad idea.
You've been talking about different months here. What exactly, you know, when do the runs start? And you had mentioned a fall spawning season, but
that's right.
When are we actually going out to fish for the Atlantic salmon?
In Canada, the season starts June 1, and in New Brunswick, it goes through October 15th, and in Quebec, it goes through the end of September. In Nova Scotia, it goes to the end, starts June 1, and it goes to the very end of October, so Halloween, basically. The more northerly Newfoundland and Labrador, I believe, I never go up there that late in the season, but I think most of their fishery is pretty well done by the end of September, and most people consider prime time that far north to be July. So we're generally looking at something like a June to end of September, and with a few exceptions like New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, an October fishery. In Europe, the fishery, some of the rivers in Scotland are open 11 months out of the year, and they have fresh fish coming in right throughout the year.
Wow.
And so it's a unique fishery if you like to have the capability of going salmon fishing just about any time of the year.
Right, right.
Canada gets too cold. I mean, you can drive your car across most salmon rivers in the middle of January. So, you know, it's a good reason for shutting it down. And a lot of the rivers, they shut down some of the upper portions of the rivers later on in the season because that's where the fish are headed to spawn. And many salmon rivers also have what's called a sanctuary, which is an area traditionally reserved for spawning where you're not allowed to fish for them at any time of the year. So Steamboat Creek would be a good example on the North Umpqua of a similar sanctuary for steelhead. And I think that's a good idea for any sea-run fishery. you know, we can fish for them on the way to the spawning grounds, but I don't think personally anyway that we should be fishing for them on the spawning beds themselves.
Right. Well, we need to take another quick break.
Okay.
When we come back, let's talk about the terminal tackle and how you rig up for those.
You bet.
Be right back. Northwoods Wanderings, the only website you will ever need about northern Maine's great outdoors. Do you hunt or fish, camp or hike? Do you kayak or paddle a canoe? If you have a taste for adventure, join Brent Reese on Northwoods Wanderings. You'll find him at www.skinnymoose.com/wanderings. That's www.skinnymoose.com/wanderings. A nationally and internationally recognized blog, it's your source for information about northern Maine. Looking for a source on fly tying information in northern Maine? Just Google Aroostook Flyers and Tires, and that's Brent's other blog. That's Aroostook, that's A-R-O-O-S-T-O-O-K, Flyers and Tires, Brent's other blog for information on fly tying in northern Maine. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Topher Brown about Atlantic salmon magic. If you'd like to ask Topher a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. When we return, I'll talk with Topher more about Atlantic salmon. Now, Topher, let's question came in about your terminal tackle and how you rig up. Is that anything complex or pretty simple? Or what have we
It's
got
pretty
there?
Simple. I use Maxima, as many do. I occasionally use fluorocarbon in the early season when there's some big fish around that like to break you off on the rocks. But for the most part, I use Maxima. And if I'm using a two-handed rod, I generally put a 10-foot polyleader on. A polyleader is a tapered butt and middle section, and they come in three or four different sink rates. I usually typically use an intermediate or a slow-sinking polyleader. And all you have to do is add a piece of level tippet to the end of that polyleader, and I generally add about 6 feet of tippet. So you get your 10-foot polyleader attached to the end of your floating fly line, and on the end of the polyleader, 6 feet of tippet, and generally 8 or 10-pound maxima, occasionally 12-pound maxima for early season when there's a few bigger fish around. That's pretty much it to go fishing. As far as single-handed rods go, I'll use sometimes a very short polyleader, about a 5-foot polyleader, and then run 6 to 7 feet of tippet right off the end of that. Sometimes I do use tapered leaders, but generally not. And I subscribe to the keep it simple and stupid philosophy of terminal tackle. I figure if there's fewer knots in my rigs, there's fewer knots to break. And so I like to keep it simple and go fishing.
Now, let's talk about flies a bit. Well, of course, everybody wants to know what the secret fly is. So we've got many questions about, you know, if you only had 3 flies to use, if you only had 5 flies to use, if you only had 1 fly to use. But Duke's got a good way to start this conversation. He asked, what are the 3 most important characteristics of an effective Atlantic salmon fly? And then maybe we can go from there into some of your favorites.
Sure. It's a really good question by Duke. You know, what makes an effective salmon fly? I think there's only really one rule about salmon flies, and that's if you're not fishing it, you won't catch any fish. So I don't think the exact pattern of fly is particularly important under most circumstances for salmon. The characteristics of a good salmon fly are really the size and the profile. And then finally, I think the speed at which it is moving. So if you have those 3 things figured out, then I don't think the actual pattern is super critical. So size is important because it's related to speed. If you fish a very small fly as a wet fly swing by casting it across current and letting it swing across at a very great rate of speed, in other words, you're fishing a small fly really, really quickly, that probably under average conditions is not going to look particularly realistic to a salmon. And that's where the relationship between the size of the fly and the speed of the fly is so critical. And it's important to, the way I look at it is, my fly is alive, and I want it to appear alive to a salmon. I also kind of want to make it react to my fly. So I take a look at a size of fly for the size of the conditions that I'm fishing, and I try to imagine how something about as big as my fly would swim in these conditions. And then when I fish it across the current, I try and come as close as I can to that speed. I'm not always right, but it gives me a starting point. In other words, if I've got a fly pattern that's 1 inch, and it's, you know, we'll call it a wheelie gun, a famous fly for Atlantic salmon, and I take another wheelie gun that's 4 inches long, same pattern, but one's 1 inch, one the other's 4 inches long, my guess is that anything that's imitating something that's 4 inches long can probably swim faster than something that's only 1 inch long. And that gives me a starting point so that if I wanted to fish a 4-inch Willy gun, which would be considered a big fly, I'd probably want to fish it pretty quick. And if I wanted to switch over to a 1-inch Willy gun without making any changes to the angle of my cast, I'd probably want to fish it slower. So that's what I mean about the relationship between the size of the fly and the speed of the fly. So those are two critical components, two parts of the tripod, if you will. The third part is the basic profile, you know, is what a fish sees when he's looking up. And I think that's fairly important. Slim flies generally seem to work better than bulky flies. And what we're looking for is a suggestion of life, not an exact imitation of life. And in my opinion, you don't want fish to see flies too well. They got incredible eyesight, and I want them to see it, but I don't want them to see it too well because I'm always afraid they're going to see it for what it is, and that is an inanimate object that I'm trying to make look like it's alive. And so the profile should be thin, and I think the fly should move along at a snappy pace, forcing the fish to react. Again, these fish are not in there in the river to feed. We're trying to get them to react to our flies, and if they have too long to look at it, sometimes they're not interested. So those are sort of the three main criteria for presentation and for flies. And I think pattern is, we all have our favorite patterns, but pattern is way down the list, the actual choice of the pattern.
What about, David from Grand Rapids asked, what about color? Is there more colors that are found to be more effective?
Yeah, definitely. And color in the salmon fly, I think, is a really interesting question. And it's related to the color of the water. And if you have essentially a bluish or a greenish tint to the water, it seems that bluish and greenish flies are more successful. For rivers that have a real tannic stain to them, the Miramichi would be an excellent example. Particularly during the later portion of the season, flies that are more closely linked to the yellow and orange and red spectrum seem to be more successful. And I think it has a lot to do with what is visible in a particular type of water. And we also know that salmon undergo changes, biological changes in their vision from the time that they come into the river to the time that they actually spawn. And as they come in from fresh water, they're more, their vision, their rods and cones in their eyes are more acute with regards to the colors blue and green on the color on the blue and green, and I would say also black, which is not typically a color. Black is just a good color you can fish all year round. As they spend a lot of time in the river, there is evidence that their vision morphs into a greater sensitivity to the color red and orange, the red and orange portions of the spectrum. So from both a perspective of what's visible in the water and what I know about the changes that occur in salmon, I generally fish blue, green, and yellow flies with black in them in the early season, and then I generally fish red and orange and purple flies at the end of the season. And I find that that seems to work pretty well across most fisheries.
Okay. And just to satisfy the curiosity of Duke and Harold in New York and Larry in Nova Scotia and Marcy in Welsh Azores and Corrigan, why don't you rattle off, you know, your top 5 or 10 that you use most often? And Marcy was kind of interested in Russia, if that was any different. So I'll quickly run through this, and then we'll talk about presentation here.
You bet. If I had one fly to fish for the rest of my days, it would probably be in a bunch of different sizes, it would probably be a Marc Leblanc fly out of Quebec called a Picasse. And Picasse,
can you spell that?
Yeah, P-I-C-A-S-S-E.
Okay.
It's a French word, which means boat anchor. And it's a very good early season fly with a yellow and black wing. And I use blue-eared pheasant. It calls for heron, which is obviously fairly tough to find. But that's just a great all-around fly. Probably my top early season fly, you know, my most successful being probably the reason it's most successful is it's usually on the end of my line. And if I was going to go to the Miramichi, I would be fishing, you know, I find it hard to take off a fly that has caught tens of thousands of fish on a specific river. So a green machine recommends itself on the Miramichi. A good all-around fly, and this kind of points to Marcy's question. I think she's going to the Umba on the south coast of the Kola Peninsula and presumably going there in September during the late season. Flies in sort of the red spectrum seem to be very successful for those what are called Osanka fish, Osanka being a fish that runs into the river in the fall but does not spawn. It actually spends anywhere from 13 to 16 months in the river before it spawns. It's a very unusual adaptation. So they're very big, healthy, strong, fat fish when they come in the fall. And flies with that in sort of the red spectrum tend to work exceptionally well. So a red butt or a particular fly on the Umba they use there, which is called a billy butt. If you just literally Google these flies, they'll pop up. Those are really good flies for the Umba. And I think, you know, the red butt or the green butt or, you know, a sort of a combination of those two flies, which is really the Undertaker, developed by Warren Duncan in St. John, New Brunswick, would be definitely sort of my third favorite fly. All three of those are in the same basic sort of category. And for number four, I'd have to go with, you know, some version of a Scandinavian temple dog, usually quite a bit slimmer, more like a sunray than a true temple dog. Again, when I'm looking for a slim profile up in the surface because I know that, you know, when salmon feed hungrily out in the ocean, they're generally eating slim, small prey, which is up in the surface, and they approach them from below. So I want my flies to appeal to that sensitivity, if you will. So some version of a sunray, or which is a Norwegian pattern, or a temple dog, but a fairly slim temple dog. And then my last sort of top five flies would be any number of bombers. Bombers being a dry fly, which we fish primarily dead drift. And I'd say my top bombers is a green bomber. It's two white wings with a white calf tail and spun and clipped green deer hair and then brown hackle run through it. I'd say that's probably my top dry fly, just called a green bomber. And those five flies will catch a fish anywhere you go for a salmon.
Sounds good. Well, let's talk about presentation a little bit. And to start this off, and because it is a little fresh in my mind as well, Dean in Westford asks, how do you vary the speed of fishing different size flies given the same water conditions and fly line? Example, how do you fish a 4-inch fly faster than a 1-inch fly?
That's a good question. If you're standing in a pool and the water is moving left to right, and you look directly across current, directly across stream, I call that 90 degrees across current. Now, if you turn downstream and you look directly downstream, I call that 0 degrees. So we're essentially, with a wet fly, we're fishing that 90-degree slice of pie, where 0 degrees is directly downstream, 90 degrees is directly across stream. So let's say you want to fish a wet fly faster. If you want to fish it faster, you typically want to make your casting angle higher. And so if you go 90 degrees is straight across current. If you go down to about 80 degrees, make a straight line cast with a wet fly and let her swing around, it will come around more quickly because the water from the current is going to hit your floating fly line and pull it across the current more quickly than if you had made a cast at a more traditional wet fly cast at, say, 45 degrees downstream. And so the first thing to do to get a faster fly is to bring your angle up. That's what we call it. And it just basically means casting more across stream. The second thing you can do is mending. A lot of folks tend to get into a repetitive groove. They make a cast across current, and they put an upstream mend into it for no particular reason. Generally, upstream mending is being where you place the floating line upstream or downstream after the cast. Generally, upstream mending is going to slow your fly, and downstream mending is going to speed it up. So if you really want to fish that 4-inch fly really quickly, you're going to make a high angle of cast at, say, 80, 85, maybe even 90 degrees, and you're going to mend downstream. You're going to put a downstream belly in it. And that's going to fish that 4-inch fly quite a bit faster than if you made a 45-degree cast and mended upstream. So you've got a tremendous range of fly speeds available to you based on two things: your casting angle, the casting angle you select and execute, and whether you mend up or downstream. And if you don't think it's moving fast enough for the conditions and the relationship of the fly size to the speed, you can cast across at 80 or 85 degrees, mend downstream, and start to strip it. That's a third variable that you can add if you're trying to speed things up. So all of this points to the intricacies of wet fly presentation, and I would make a pretty strong argument that it's more complex than nymphing, and it's more complex than fishing a dry fly, because there are so many variables with casting angle, mending, and stripping, which you can add to your presentation to influence the speed and even the angle of the fly in the current.
Yeah. Another question by Duke. Duke asked a lot of questions. I thank him for that. And he asked a lot of good questions.
He does.
He says, can you kind of walk us through how you read the river when you're searching for Atlantic salmon different times of the year? Describe characteristics of good holding water.
You bet. Salmon seem to like what I call a good push of water. In other words, they don't necessarily hold in trout water. If you are a trout fisherman and you look for good places for trout, there may be a salmon there, but the odds are good that good salmon holding water is elsewhere. You're dealing with a fish that's considerably larger on average than most trout, and so it can generally hold in a stronger push of water. And describing a good push of water is difficult. I think the best way to do it is to see a few fish and get a feel for the current speed that they're looking for in those conditions, and then look for that current speed elsewhere in the river. As a general rule of thumb, if the water is high, if it's above average, if you go into a river for the very first time and everybody's saying, boy, the water is really up, it's pretty high, it's a good bet that most of the fish are going to be in the tails of the pool where the current is slowest. So that's generally where I concentrate my fishing efforts. And if I'm looking for fish, sight fishing, that's where I look first. High water, tail of the pool. If the river's running at exceptionally low levels, everybody's saying, boy, we've never seen the water so low, or we really need some water around here, that nice push of water is generally going to be up towards the head of the pool. And that's where the current is at its quickest. That's where the water is at its most oxygenated. So in low water, I will typically look and concentrate my fishing efforts at the head of the pool, because I know that's where the fish should be. Now, they'll definitely surprise you, but if you can come up with a general rule that takes care of 80% of salmon behavior, you're doing pretty good. When the river's running at medium levels, everybody's saying this is perfect level for fishing this river, the fish can be mostly anywhere, but you'll generally find them in what I call the belly of the pool, which is right smack dab in the middle of the river, in the middle of the pool. That's, generally the best place, but they can be in the head, they can be in the tail. But that's probably the greatest challenge to your water reading skills, is when there's a lot of good holding water, because the fish, if they're moving, can be virtually anywhere. So in those conditions, the ability to cover lots of water can reward you with more fish than if you simply concentrate on a few good-looking spots. Because if the fish are moving, they can be up and down the river. But that's sort of a general overview of reading salmon water.
Okay. Norm in Ireland asks, what are your thoughts about sunshine intensity and the most effective depth of presentation, and also about depth of presentation and the size of the fly to be used?
It's a good question and a complex one. Fish don't generally like bright sunshine, and you can still catch them in bright sunshine, but you got to sort of pick your spots, in my opinion. If it's exceptionally bright, sometimes fish, I find, will move up into a little bit faster water, and because the overhead commotion of faster water often provides them with a little bit of visual protection from predators and so forth and so on. So I'll fish for them in those, you know, I know that they may move in up into the head of the pool and even into the rapids if the waters, if the conditions are very bright. And I'll typically go to a slim black fly in those conditions. If you don't have a lot of competition, it can often be a better choice to simply wait for the high sun to get off the pool before you fish for them. You don't always have that luxury if there's other people competing for the same water. But if it's a private pool, then if the sun is really beating down, right, and the fish are looking right into it, right upstream into it, I'll oftentimes wait until the sun gets off the pool before I go to work fishing for them, because I know that my chances of getting them to come up and play, as it were, are better in those conditions. As far as depth goes, depth, I think, is really related to water temperature. And generally, as it gets colder, flies should be fished more deeply. You know, it's not that you can't catch a fish in 48-degree water on a floating line. You definitely can. But if you're fishing a sinking tip and you can get your fly down a few inches, or fishing a full sinking line and get your line down a few feet when the water is, say, 45 degrees Fahrenheit or 42 degrees Fahrenheit, I feel you will generally hook quite a few more fish. And that is related to the cold-blooded nature of a fish, and they simply are not as active in colder water. So the importance of getting your fly to the fish is critical as the temperature gets below about 48, I'm talking water temperature here, below about 48 degrees or so. It's important not to think that just getting your flies closer to fish is going to get you more fish, because a lot of these guys, I think all salmon, are looking up. So even if you're fishing a sinking line, you still want to fish your fly probably in about the middle of the water column so that the fish can look up at them. And as the water warms and gets above 50 to 52, oftentimes you'll be more successful if you take that sinking line off and go to a floating line and start to fish your flies up in the surface. Given the upward-looking and very visual nature of salmon, that's usually the best tactic once that water gets above 50, 52.
Okay. Let me take a quick break, and we'll come right back, and we'll talk more about these presentation techniques and getting hooked up. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as a seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters today and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to his website, www.flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Topher Brown about Atlantic salmon. If you'd like to ask Topher a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Topher, tons of questions left. There's a question about changes in strategy regarding sunny days versus overcast days. Now, you just addressed kind of the idea of a bright, sunny midday occurrence, but right. Is it better fishing in the morning, in the afternoon, or in the evening?
Yeah, I mean, I will definitely, and I think most experienced salmon fisher will change their tactics and remain flexible based on what they're dealing with. And if they know that it's going to be 90 degrees Fahrenheit and there won't be a cloud in the sky, the sun will be beating down, most of us that have done a fair amount of salmon fishing are going to get up real early, because we know that we're going to get our coolest water temperature of the day and the sun will be off the water very early in the morning. So if you are able to fish at 4:30 in the morning, that would be my preferred time in those types of conditions. If you get a July day where it is a nice drizzle and a steady overcast and it's cool, I'll fish right through the day because I know that, you know, there's no bright sun pounding down on the water and the water temperatures are well within comfort range of Atlantic salmon. And so I can have good fishing right through the day based on the weather. So I think the strategies, I think good salmon fishermen and good fishermen in general are flexible with regards to water conditions and the weather that is presented with them in front of them as they go to the river, and they adapt based on what they see. And, you know, if the conditions are very, very warm water and a beating down sun, you know, you may knock it off at 9 o'clock and not fish again until the evening. And I've been on many rivers which are still too warm in the evening to fish. So oftentimes the best fishing in August on these types of rivers with beating sun and warmer temperatures is a very narrow window from, you know, first light up till about 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning. And then 3 days later on that same river, the air temperature can go down and you can get a nice steady rain all day long. And 3 days later, you're fishing all through the day on the same exact river. So a lot of variables.
Now, let's Duke asked a question, too, about what are your most effective fishing techniques for salmon. Explain why you choose one technique over another. And then also, you know, does your technique change based on the behavior of the fish, what you're seeing?
Definitely. A lot of different techniques from, you know, say, the dry fly to the riffling hitch, which is a waking wet fly across the surface, to a wet fly, which is a swinging wet fly, to what I call a sunk fly, which I differentiate from a wet fly, because it's typically fished deeper and more slowly than most wet fly presentations. So all of those different techniques have their time and their place when they're going to be most effective. And there's also personal preference involved in there as well. Some anglers are willing to fish dry flies because they love to see a fish come up and take a dry fly when they know they could probably catch more fish by fishing wet flies right through the day. And so personal preference, you know, we go angling to enjoy ourselves, not to put food on the table necessarily, is, I think, an important part of the game. You're out there to have fun and to enjoy yourself. And if you feel like catching a fish on a dry fly, you know, then I think, you know, you should go for it. If you really want to catch a fish and you really don't care how you fish, then I think you have to have enough experience to know what the fish are likely to take given the conditions. And it depends greatly on where you are in the world. If you're in Quebec on a clear salmon river, and by clear I mean rivers that have underwater visibility of 150 feet, you're probably going to approach that in August very differently than you would approach early June fishing in Russia. And you're probably going to run into very high cold water, and a sinking line and a big visible fly will probably be very appropriate for early season in Russia. If you're fishing low water on exceptionally clear rivers on the Gaspé Peninsula in Quebec in August, you're going to be better off probably with some dry flies, perhaps some smaller wet flies, and you may wish to try the hitch as well under those conditions. So it depends. There's so many variables in the game between the time of the year, the level of the river, the temperature of the water, and the actual conditions of the day, beating down sun or a nice steady drizzle. And all of those have to be factored into a presentation tactic that is appropriate for what you see in front of you. And then on top of it, there's the personal preference. If I go up in August to fish in Quebec, I know that's typically one of the best times for dry flies. So even if it's not producing particularly well on the dry fly, I love to fish dry flies, so I'll probably stick with a dry fly in the hopes that a fish or two will come up and take a look at it, just because that's my only opportunity of the year to fish lots of dry flies. So to me, that's important. But all around, make sure that whatever tactic you choose, you enjoy fishing, and it's more or less appropriate for the conditions that are in front of you.
Okay. Now, we had a question from Ed in Templeton, California, about hook set. He says it's a very common occurrence to miss hookups with steelhead, and he's wondering about Atlantic salmon. Is that necessarily the case there? Is it?
And it's a good question. And the big difference between fishing a dry fly, and we typically fish dry flies certainly in North America, which is really eastern Canada these days, we fish dry flies dead drift, so they're not waking. And so when a fish comes up and takes a dead drift dry fly, you have to set the hook on that fish as soon as he closes his mouth on the fly. If not, they tend to spit it out, and, you know, they're not going to set the hook on themselves. So it's important to set the hook on an Atlantic salmon with a dry fly, a dead drift dry fly, much as you would do with a trout. I don't think it's really all that much different in terms of the timing, except sometimes you can get into some bigger fish, and bigger fish tend to do things more slowly than smaller fish. So if you get a big 20-pound salmon coming up to inhale your bomber, oftentimes it seems to take an age before they close their mouth on it, so you don't want to be too quick on them. Wet flies, probably not unlike what the type of wet fly fishing that Ed is doing for steelhead on the West Coast, wet flies are a different story, and you generally don't want to set the hook for Atlantic salmon with a wet fly. Your fly is being fished across current under tension, and we tend to fish a fairly fast fly, particularly with floating lines or very light sink tips. We fish a fast fly for Atlantic salmon, so when they get it, when they take it, they usually set the hook themselves, so it's a mistake to quickly set the hook with a wet fly. And so I think the biggest difficulty is for trout fishers that are learning to fish wet flies, whether it be for steelhead or for salmon. And if they're nymph fishermen, they're used to setting the hook as soon as they feel a bump, or they see the indicator slow, or they think a fish may have taken it. That type of behavior when fishing wet flies for either steelhead or Atlantic salmon, but particularly for Atlantic salmon, will definitely lose you or cost you a lot of fish. Because when a fish is taking a wet fly, he's more or less pointed, his open maw, as it were, is pointed more or less in your general direction. And so if you set the hook instantly, as soon as you see him or feel him, you're more than likely to pull that fly right out of his mouth. If you don't really do anything at all, the fish will generally come up on a wet fly, take it, and then he wants to return to his lie. So as he goes down and comes up to take your fly and then goes down back towards his lie, you'll oftentimes feel a nice steady pull. And when you feel that steady pull, you still don't have to set the hook. All you have to do is smoothly and gently raise your rod up to about 45 degrees, and you got him.
Game on, huh?
Game on. If you're too quick, you're probably going to pull that fly right out of his mouth, or you're going to hook him right on the outside of the mouth, and you might lose him in a couple of minutes. So mellow is good with regards to setting, you know, the speed of setting, you know, and I think setting the hook is just a bad metaphor in wet fly fishing. You just kind of let the fish do the work and just kind of let it happen. And with dry flies, if you're a good trout fisherman with dry flies, you're all set. Just fish for them, like, you know, set the hook just like you would for a bigger trout, and you'll be in good shape.
So in many respects, fishing for Atlantic salmon is similar to steelhead fishing.
I think so. Yeah, I think there are more similarities than differences in salmon and steelhead fishing. But the differences are marked and important. Salmon tend to hold in faster water than steelhead, so a lot of times the lines that we use, particularly in the early season, are a little bit different in order to keep our flies in that fast, that heavy push of water where we oftentimes find salmon in the early season, particularly larger salmon. And fly speed is different. Most salmon seem to prefer a faster fly than steelhead. So I've guided a fair number of steelhead fishermen, and it's really tough to get them to mend downstream with floating fly lines. They want to mend upstream and slow things down and sort of keep the fly in front of the fish. And that's not always productive with salmon. Getting the fly to swing through a lie quickly is usually more productive, and that means a high angle of cast and sometimes a downstream mend in order to speed things up, make it look like that fly is trying to get away as opposed to holding it in front of their nose. And so there are important differences, and there's also a size difference. You know, there are very few steelhead rivers where you have to worry about running into fish 25 pounds and up. And so if you're fishing on big fish rivers in Norway or early season in Quebec, or early season in the Kola Peninsula, the north coast of the Kola Peninsula, you want to gear up appropriately. You know, so I would say, you know, for big fish salmon rivers, you'd want to gear up more for, like you'd be gearing up for Chinook or chum salmon. A lot of rivers, you know, the fish salmon rivers, Atlantic salmon rivers, the fish are not that big, and then you can use the same basic stuff you'd use for the average 6 to 12, 13-pound steelhead. But There are certainly some differences, but there's a lot of similarities. And if you're a good steelhead fisherman, I think in general, you're going to find the transition over to salmon to be a lot easier than if you didn't steelhead fish at all. So, and I know a lot of folks that do both, and I definitely would like to do more steelhead fishing. I've been to the West Coast a few times to fish for steelhead. It's every bit as good a game, and the fish is every bit as good as an Atlantic salmon. They're, they're kin, as far as I'm concerned, on the sporting hierarchy.
Well, we've got a bunch more questions, but I'm going to make this last question and combine a bunch of them together. And I know earlier you had, before the show, you had said that if people had unanswered questions or things that came up later, that you might be available to field some of those questions.
Sure.
Still an offer that's on the
table? Yeah, that's definitely an offer. If you, if you've got a question, as long as it's not too complicated, yeah, just fire me off an email. My email address is topherbrown, T-O-P-H-E-R-B-R-O-W-N-E, at AOL.com. And it's important to put that E after my name. And topherbrown at AOL.com.
Perfect.
And I'll do, you know, just say you had a, you asked a question or you had a question from the broadcast this evening, and I'll do my best to answer it.
Okay.
And we'll go
so one
there.
Final question here. I'm going to throw a bunch of them together here. Duke asked, of all the locations, Canada, Iceland, Russia, Norway, which do you think is the maybe the primo destination for salmon? And also, what are some of the accessible spots in Canada, and as John Wainwright puts it, where people can go who are not millionaires to find productive water?
That's a good question, because I definitely fall into that category. there's lots of you don't need, you know, salmon, definitely Atlantic salmon have a reputation for being the sport of kings, but you don't need a royal horde in order to go fishing for them. And Nova Scotia is, all you need is a fishing license. There's no charge for access to the water. You need a salmon fishing license, and you can fish any of the scheduled salmon rivers right throughout the season. So it's no more expensive than going to Montana, you know, to fish for trout. Quebec has a little bit of a different program. You do not need a guide, just as you do not need a guide in Nova Scotia. But they have a daily access fee, which varies from anywhere from, for a non-resident, from $45 to about $75 for a lot of the public water. And so, again, you can fish really nice salmon rivers, particularly on the Gaspé Peninsula. You know, fishing will probably cost you, you know, call it $50 a day, $50 to $60 a day. And that's pretty reasonable for world-class quality Atlantic salmon fishing. New Brunswick is a little different. You need a guide, and that generally means an outfitter. And most outfitters are going to charge, you know, somewhere between $400 and $550 a day to go fishing in New Brunswick. So that would be the Miramichi or the Restigouche River. And you also need a guide by law to fish in Newfoundland and Labrador, so that will increase the cost. But you can hire a guide, and all the water is public. If you're not a resident of Newfoundland or Labrador, which most of us aren't, you can fish anywhere as long as you are employing a guide for the day. So there's lots of water to fish, and a guide will typically run you, I don't know, maybe $150 a day, something like that. You can stay at a motel. So there's a lot of opportunities to fish for Atlantic salmon in Atlantic Canada without totally breaking the bank. Mm-hmm. When you start talking Iceland and the North Coast and the Kola Peninsula, things get more expensive. A lot of the best water in Iceland is anywhere from $500 to $1,500 a day.
Wow.
And you can spend during prime time on the big fish rivers of the Kola Peninsula, you can easily spend $2,000 a day for fishing. But there's lots of rivers where you can, if you can eliminate helicopter travel, rivers like the Kola River and rivers like the Umba River, which you can drive to, you can fish a lot of those rivers on the Kola Peninsula of Russia for pretty reasonable pretty reasonable figures, and that's
right.
That's usually the best opportunity for many of us to fish in Russia.
Right.
And a lot of the rivers in particularly northern Norway, and Norway has over 400 scheduled salmon rivers. They're, it's probably the most prolific, one of the most prolific countries for Atlantic salmon. A lot of that is daily access water and very inexpensive. I've fished a lot of those rivers for $35 a day. You stay in a motel and fish great rivers for $35 a day. Definitely an adventure. You don't need a guide. And when I say northern Norway, I'm talking about the Finnmark region of Norway. So way the heck up there, the Arctic Circle and north.
Well, lots of options. Lots of options.
Lots of options.
Most of our audience they all have their own, personal helicopters, so that wouldn't be a problem. So they won't have to pay for the helicopter.
Yeah, I think it's important to know that, lots of folks, you go to Canada, and what I like to see is, when everybody gets off of work and they go down to the pool in back of the town, and, all the locals and the kids, they all go fishing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's healthy for our resource because people are personally invested in the river, and we're also teaching the youngsters how to fish as opposed to play on their Game Boy. And one of the biggest reasons that public access on salmon rivers is a good idea is it means we've got more fishermen. And if we've got more fishermen, then we've got more advocates for the fish.
Right.
And and there's plenty of public access water in all the Canadian provinces. In Norway, there's even good day ticket water in Scotland. If you do a little research, you can definitely find it out. You can spend plenty of money on your salmon fishing, but you don't have to. And I think that's healthy for our sport.
Terrific. Well, unfortunately, it's time to wrap things up, Topher.
Okay.
I want everybody to stick around, though. We're going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine and also your latest book, Atlantic Salmon Magic. And Wild River Press is helping us out with providing that nice gift. So we'll be right back, and we'll give those prizes away.
Okay, great. Thank you, Roger.
Sure. A mining company called Pacgrim Coal is planning a massive strip mine near Anchorage, Alaska. The Chuitna Coal Project would be the first project in Alaskan history to mine directly through salmon habitat. The Chuitna River drainage, 11 miles of it, this is critical commercial sport and subsistence fishing economies, there would be permanently destroyed. Pacgrim says it can rebuild the salmon stream, but scientific experts find no example where successful restoration has occurred after strip mining. Chuitna Coal would be shipped to Asia, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon runs. It's time to stop the Chuitna Coal Strip Mine. For more information on how you can help, visit www.inletkeeper.org, that's inletkeeper.org, or go to www.trustees.org, trustees.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, "What did you think of this show?" Just click on that link and leave us your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away our prizes. And our first prize is going for the one-year membership to Federation of Fly Fishers. And if you want to learn more about the Federation, which is a great organization to support, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. So our winner of the one-year membership there is Chris France in North Carolina. Chris France, so congratulations, Chris, and I know you'll enjoy that membership. Our second giveaway tonight is for a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. To learn more about Fly Fusion, go to www.flyfusionmag.com. That's flyfusionmag.com. And our winner for that is Ashik Rahman. Ashik Rahman, and Ashik is in New York. So, Ashik, congratulations on winning that subscription. I know you'll enjoy it and learn a lot from it. So, enjoy. Okay, now This is where we, Topher, we ask a question to see who was paying attention the past hour and a half. And I'm going to ask a two-part question here. And if they want to get this beautiful book you've created, they'll need to answer it correctly. So here is the two questions. One, which river in Maine seems to have the most promise right now and biggest salmon runs? And what double-handed casting method does Topher prefer and normally use if the conditions are such that he can? So the river in Maine that's got the big salmon runs going on right now and the double-handed casting method. Need to answer them both correctly. And I think, no, I don't think this is it. We've got the first answer says Penobscot River, and which is correct, right? But he's got Skagit Cast. That's not what we were looking for, was it, Topher?
It's a good cast. I'm usually more on the Scandinavian side of things.
And our next answer, I think, got it. They got the river right, the Penobscot, and Scandi.
That's right.
That's right. Okay, so Sean Keeney in Foxborough, Massachusetts, you just won yourself a beautiful book. So congratulations on paying attention, and you're definitely going to benefit from it. So, Sean, congratulations again. You're really going to enjoy this book. For those of you that didn't get it, didn't win tonight, again, you can go to wildriverpress.com, wildriverpress.com, and pick up a copy there and explore it a bit further there. Now, it's time to close things up here. Topher, I really appreciate you being on the show again with us. And
thank you, Roger.
Glad you made it back across the pond safely and enjoyed yourself. Hopefully it was a fruitful business trip as well over there. And I look forward to reading more of your book and doing some of this fishing down the road.
Sounds great.
Thanks a lot. Our next broadcast will be on August 24th. September 7th at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. On that show, we'll be interviewing Gary Borger, and our topic for the show will be Reading Waters. Gary will explain the characteristics of moving water, examining the three types of lies and how to identify them and fish them from small streams to massive rivers. He will also take on and remove some of the mystery out of reading lakes and ocean flats. So Reading Water is always a big topic, so be there for that show. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Housatonic River Outfitters, Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska, Northwoods Wanderings, and Flats Time Charters for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.